There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Opera GX.
Now this week on Retronauts, Deep Space Squid. Hello and welcome to Retronauts, the only podcast where the height of military strategy is marching back and forth while slowly descending. This time we will be focused on Space Invaders, which explains my extremely bad joke. It's the best I could come up with. I apologize retroactively. And yeah, I'm shocked to discover that this game has never gotten its own episode in this entire run of this podcast, which is wild.
What's wrong with you people? What's wrong with you people?
Right? It's extremely influential, important to the medium, and frankly to Japanese, like, game culture in general, so I'm really excited, but before we continue, I guess we should introduce my guest. Who was it that just spoke up there?
It's me, Matt Ault. It's always a pleasure to be on the podcast, and there's nothing I like talking about more literally than Space Invaders, so this is great.
And who is in the same country as Matt?
Hello, this is Diamond Fight. And Kevin, I think the answer is we have, up until now, enforced a boycott because Space Invaders is a complete misnomer because you do not invade space. So, you know, I understand, Kevin, you want to break with protocol, you're a rebel. You know, we can't stop you. But let's be honest, it's a terrible title.
Listen, I don't play by the rules, but I get results. And who is our fourth member of this Three Musketeers?
Hello, it's Brian Clark from 1 Million Power, and I still haven't lost count of my shots. I'm coming up on 14 any second now.
Don't miss that UFO. Don't right? miss it. That's 300 points.
I know. Well, if I'm on count anyway.
That's always the struggle. So to be clear, this is not going to cover the entire series of Space Invaders games, because there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of sequels and spin-offs and remakes, and frankly, that could be its own podcast episode at some point. But instead, we're gonna narrow in, we're gonna focus down on the original 1978 game and a few related works, the like immediate sequel and some of the more interesting ports and whatnot. That I feel are either interesting or important to discuss.
Can I ask a question? Are all of us veterans of the Space Invaders Wars? If so, thank you for your service. I am a veteran. I experienced it in real time. I was about 5 or 6 years old when it first came out. How about you?
I definitely played it in arcades. I definitely remember the cabinet. In arcades, you know, as an American, I remember looking at the monsters on the outside of the cabinet, and then I look up the front, like, oh, that's not what's on the cabinet. All right, but this game is fun. I'm not going to complain about it. And then, as we'll get into it, the Atari home port is what I probably spent the most time on because that was in my basement. I didn't have to go anywhere. So, oh, just go to the basement and play Space Invaders. Okay, yeah. You sold me.
Its initial release predated me a bit. I did. Played in arcades when I was fairly young, though, but I didn't really get into it, like get into the scoring and like really figuring out how the game ticked until honestly, like a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was when the Invincible Collection dropped and you finally got to dig into it. Yeah. As for me, my primary experience, because I think I'm the youngest one on here, was the 2600 port, which I played the crap out of. It's one of my first gaming memories is playing that one. I remember seeing the arcade machine around a few times, usually out of order because it was the 90s. But Yeah, I sank a lot of time into it over the years, just from like the different home conversions, and whenever I got to see a cab, I would inevitably drop some quarters in. But also, when the Invincible Collection came out, I also got a chance to really dig into how it ticks. And it's a really fascinating game. Like, there's a lot of complexity that you wouldn't expect out of a 1978 release.
Well, I think it's kind of emergent complexity. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if even Mr. Nishikado, who created the game, knew how much of a kind of a pull it would have on people. And I think really Space Invaders is the first game to kind of leave the arcades and become a cultural experience, a cultural phenomenon, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about as this goes on. But I mean, literally the soundtrack of my youth, which much too much of which was spent in arcades, is there's so much of that Invaders beat going on, that relentless it was one of the things you could hear kind of in the background of every arcade when you went into in the late 70s, early 80s, that it was just omnipresent. And so it's really intimately kind of associated with my misbegotten youth.
Given that the leading scoring technique is the result of an unintended bug, I think you're probably onto something with Mr. Nishikado not maybe fully understanding what the game was going to end up turning into.
Hey, look, sometimes, you know, these things happen. Like Street Fighter 2 wasn't supposed to have combos. It just did, you know?
Yeah,
and right.
Sometimes you revolutionize an entire industry by accident. Whoopsie.
Yeah.
Oops.
And Space Invaders really did revolutionize things. I mean, it's hard to imagine, would we be here, all of us, would gaming be here, would we have gotten to now without Space Invaders? It seems like an exaggeration, but I really don't think it is.
I don't think Japan would still be here. I think they would have closed down. They would have shut down in the 80s. They would have sold off their assets at some point, you know?
Yeah. So we didn't invent the ultimate game. We could just stop. We're just done. We're going to disband. we're over.
I'm not sure that Taito would still be here in all honesty, if not for Space Invaders. I think there's a very good chance that they wouldn't still be around.
Or certainly they would have cut out of video games, I think, because this was a breakout hit.
Yes, so to speak. I mean, Taito is, I'm sure we're going to get into this, but as I'm sure you guys know, Taito is such an interesting story, founded by that Ukrainian entrepreneur, you know, escapee of the Russian, like, Jewish pogroms. He's, like, raised in Manchukuo, like, under Japanese occupation. It's just this amazing, like, socio-historical link to video gaming. But yes, I think they were, to quote Frank Zappa, they were only in it for the money, and games were where the money was at in the 1970s, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. I guess before we jump into all the background, for the five people who don't know what Space Invaders is, but are still listening to this,
Yes, exactly. This
is a shooting game, came out in 78 by Taito, published internationally by Midway. There's 55 aliens that sort of march in a big block left and right on the screen. Every time they hit an edge, they drop down one line, and you have to shoot them all before they touch the ground, because if they do that, you lose the game. Occasionally a UFO goes by. There has a quote-unquote random point bonus if you shoot it, but it's actually
random.
It's not random. They did not have the space on the program for that. So instead it's based on your shot count. So that's something people figured out fairly early on. You play until you either run out of lives or the invaders hit the ground. Unusual for these sorts of games in 78, they shoot back at you. And just having lives is unusual for 78. Having multiple waves of invaders coming at you is extremely unusual for 78.
If I might add, what's also extremely, extremely rare for 1978 is having recognizable characters. You know, now every video game has recognizable, merchandisable characters in them, but Space Invaders was really the first. You know, those squids and those crabs and those, you know, whatever they are, they're War of the Worlds looking little guys. those were really the first recognizable characters in the video game pantheon, I believe.
Yeah, and they are still, like, extremely prevalent. You know, I remember when we visited Tokyo in 2019, yeah. Brian, there's still a lot of, like, little Space Invaders, like, iconography all over
even
the place.
Even Taito's own merchandise is still, they're still plentiful.
Yeah, yes. Taito still operates some game centers here in Japan, probably not as many as they used to, but they're still open, and usually the signage will have a very large invader on the sign. Yes. Indeed, the last time I went to one down in Osaka near Denden Town, I remember I was with my son that day, and we went up, we sort of walked around the game center, and they had a Space Invaders machine on free play, just in there. So, I think I'm the only person among us who has done their duty and tried to impart the Space Invaders wisdom to the next generation firsthand. Now, he was very young at the time, so I don't know if he was caught on it by anything, but he did shoot off some invaders, so, you know, he's now a veteran too. He's a veteran as well.
it's heritage. It's right. You got to pass down that heritage and that culture. You know, and also we can't, if you're talking about Tokyo, and this isn't actually limited to Tokyo, we can't forget the French graffiti artist Invader, mm-hmm. whose little tile, it's not even graffiti. It's street art, I guess you'd call it. He makes these little tile sculptures of mosaics of Space Invaders and puts them up in cities all over the world. It's actually quite fun to walk around Tokyo and look for them. They're hidden, kind of in plain sight, and definitely another inspiration from the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God. When my wife and I went to Britain for our honeymoon, they were all over the place in London and a few of the other cities we visited. So
it makes sense. He's been banned for life from Japan, unfortunately, after being caught. But you know, because you know he's making invaders instead of fighting them, and so the Japanese government is like, "No, no, you have to destroy the invaders. You're out. You're out. Game over."
That's so wild. I mean, to think I've actually been to a Banksy exhibit in Japan. So it's like, if you get too famous before you get caught, it's okay. But if you get caught before you're famous enough, then you get banned, you know?
Yes, exactly. Because now, you know, it's funny. I actually heard, and I don't know how true this is, that Shibuya in particular is seeing that as a kind of heritage, the street art, the graffiti, and now they're kind of lobbying to get his ban lifted so he can come back again. So how times change.
Amazing. Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned earlier just the beat, the incessant invader march, like, that's, I feel like that's also become iconic in its own right. I remember hearing about the invader houses, which we'll get to, just like the arcades of just Space Invaders, and they would just, like, put the speakers out front.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Just hooked up to a machine, so you just hear the march.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, it's like primitive EDM, or you know what I mean, or like techno. You can kind of dance to it, I guess. Although it's kind of relentless. It's designed to make you stressed out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a whammy. They're trying to put the whammy on you when you're playing. It would be interesting to try playing it without any sound at all. You know, maybe it's actually easier.
I've done it in arcades. It's not fun.
I also feel like being like I will admit I've never been in an arcade with more than one Space Invaders machine present in it.
Oh, okay.
But imagining hearing a cacophony of multiple Space Invaders machines all at different points in the gameplay, so you're just constantly hearing different speeds of the dun 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 dun. Seems like it would be a maddening experience.
Or like one of those concerts where they perform, like, you know, game music, you know, orchestral. Mm-hmm. We should do that. We should have an orchestra perform the dun-dun-dun.
Surely that must have happened somewhere by now.
Probably. In Japan, it must have, yes.
Undoubtedly. And I know that beat was used in, like, different, like, Space Invaders parody songs or themed songs. And I also know that, you know, Kyari Pamyu Pamyu used it in her song Invader, like just the four note beat, like dun 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 dun. She even sings it out during the chorus. So like
we need a vocal version of the Space Invaders game. You know, like you just have her saying dun 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 over and over again.
Well, you know,
this must have been done too in Japan at some point.
There is that Game Center CX Space Invaders thing that Taito made for their anniversary. Was it their game's 30th?
I don't remember which anniversary, but yeah.
I think it was the 30th anniversary, and they had Arano do all the sound effects.
I don't think he did the dun 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 dun, though. I think he just did like, you know, like little like sound effects like that, like of the shots and things like that. Shots.
He did do the UFOs. I have to double check the footage from the TV show.
Put it in the show notes.
Yep.
But actually, I'm glad you brought up Kiari Pamapam because I think that's important to realize that, first of all, that is a young contemporary performer. Like yeah. she was not alive during the Invader boom. She was like, I mean, if you do the math, I think she was born in the 90s. I mean, I think she's relatively young now. I know, like, she just recently had her first child, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, born in the 90s ain't young anymore, buddy.
Right. I'm just saying young compared to us here, but right. Still, like, she's relatively contemporary. I'm sure, like, once she's done with her maternity leave, she'll be back and she'll be doing all the stuff that she does, which is, you know, kind of out there. She's kind of, you know, she's one of the, I would say odder, obviously not super odd given Japan's legacy of weird acts, but like Kiari is definitely on the odder end of the spectrum. So for the sure. fact that she would release a song in the 21st century about a video game that was probably almost 40 years old at that point, because we're getting close to 50 at this point. Mm-hmm. And that was her theme. And everyone's like, yes, we love it. Yes. Thank you. More Kiari. Thank you.
It's like it would be like Lady Gaga issuing a song about Donkey Kong.
Yes,
which, right. which you know, if metaphor. She wants to do it, I'd be fine. But
I want to see, can Lady Gaga show up at an event just wearing a barrel? Like she could do that.
Yeah,
she could.
I think she can. If she showed up at an event wearing a dress made of nothing but steaks sewn together, I'm sure that she could do that. But I mean, it's a testament to the cultural impact of Space Invaders. Very few games have this kind of pull. You know what I mean? It's like, it's beyond.
I'm sorry. Wait. Lady Gaga, she's the lady from Donkey Kong. Oh, what are we boy. Doing here? Oh my God.
Oh, geez.
It all comes together.
Time for a name change. She's going to just Lady now.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Opera GX. Hey folks, let's talk about the internet for a minute. We're all on it, unless you're currently driving, in which case, pull over, please. Thank you. So despite the many innovations that have arrived in this 21st century of ours, it feels like web browsers have been in a period of decline. And if you're like me, you've been locked into using the same one for well over a decade. But I'm here to tell you, it doesn't have to be like that. Take control of your life, bust out of the prison built around you by your current browser, and make the change to Opera GX. Now, I know what you're saying. A good portion of my adult life is tied to my current browser of choice. Change can be scary, but with Opera GX, you won't need to start your internet browsing experience from scratch. Opera GX allows you to import all of your settings from your previous browser, and it's even compatible with every Chrome extension. So even if you've customized your current browsing experience to fit your needs, you'll find it very easy to enable those same options and find a wealth of new ones by using Opera GX. That's right, in terms of giving you the most efficient, customizable way to explore the internet, Opera GX is the king of browsers. And while Opera GX and GX mods have already brought us an unprecedented level of customization, these options now go above and beyond. In fact, there's over 9,000 mods to choose from. Please insert your own anime reference here. Opera GX will bring you back to an era when web browsers used to be customizable and fun. With Opera GX, you can add themes and wallpaper, add a splash screen that appears whenever you open the browser, and even add background music to your browsing experience. And on that note, my favorite Opera GX mod is called Lo-Fi Chill. I often listen to instrumental music while I work, and thanks to this little mod, I can spend more time working on podcasts like this one and less time browsing for the perfect JRPG music playlist. Folks, there are far too many positives to mention in a single ad, but before I go, I wanted to note Opera GX's GX control feature. Now, I'm mostly a PC gamer, and I often have wikis open to aid me in my various quests. So we all know how these sites can be absolute resource hogs, but with GX Control, I get to decide how much CPU and RAM Opera GX can use. And that means no FPS drops. And folks, I'm an FPS purist. Anything less than 60 and I walk. But you don't have to take my word for it. Try Opera GX for yourself. Just use my link in the show notes to try Opera GX today. Thank you to Opera GX for sponsoring this episode.
So where to begin with this? Where to even start? I mean, it's the lore is deep.
So I want to dig into like Taito and how like Space Invaders came to be initially, and y'all can feel free to chime in as we go through a lot of these details. Tomohiro Nishikado, he had a biography come out I forget, almost 10 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
By French historian Florent Gorges. I probably mangled that because I can never remember how it's pronounced.
Gorges,
probably. It's available in French and in Japanese. You can find...
Tough to find, though.
Yeah, a little tough to find. It's an older book, but it's very informative. Also, the Space Invaders Invincible collection had a lot of details from other folks who worked on the game and contemporary coverage. And Nishikado's done a million interviews over the years.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So anyway, you going to say something?
No, I was going to say that to me, if we're going to talk about the game first, or are we going to talk about Taito first? There's so many angles here. I don't even know where to begin.
I want to start with Taito because a lot of things between Taito and Midway and, Taito's electromechanical games really lead up to Space Invaders.
Sure.
It all sort of feeds into that game.
Well, they didn't get us. Their start was not in games, is my understanding. Michael Kogan, I believe,
yes,
is his name. Mm-hmm. The Ukrainian-born, Odessa-born entrepreneur fled that area because he was of Jewish descent. Moves to Manchuria, which is not Manchukuo because it's invaded by the Japanese. Somehow hooks up with the Japanese intelligence services in Manchuria. And helps them with this this sounds like I'm making this up. Project Fugu, which was a top secret project to resettle Jews in Manchukuo to help Japan curry favor with the West to get them to stop boycotting Japan for invading Manchuria and China. And it's like, why is it called Project Fugu? Why, like, imagine this, like the Jewish Holy Land is suddenly in Manchuria instead of Israel. It's all of this stuff is just so mind-blowing. But then what happens? The Soviets, of course, advance, take over, and Michael Kogan flees in 1944, not to the West, but he flees to Japan, to Tokyo, which was not a great place to be in 1944 to 1945.
Generally, I'm sorry.
Generally, it was really, bad place. Putting aside the fact that there's shortages of all kinds, famines, whatever, then the B-29s came in March of 1944 and leveled huge sections of the city. Obviously, he survived this, but he was like an entrepreneur, right? And he ran his first company in China. Like, it was like a wig and like perfume and like all of these other kinds of things. And then he moves to Japan and he starts doing like an import-export business. Again, this is not exactly a great time to launch a business in Japan. Like, the economy is destroyed. All of the infrastructure is destroyed. You only have the black markets. So like, what he's doing and how he's getting his stuff off the ground, I don't know. But he does it. He's a very successful businessman and he launches Taito, I believe, in the early 50s is my understanding of it.
I'm hit by so many things at once. I can't believe I can't believe that there was almost a Jewish homeland in China. It's like,
yes.
Imagine trading one troublesome,
can you imagine?
One troublesome maelstrom in one part of the world for a completely different troublesome maelstrom in another part of the world. And then the man fled one war zone into another war zone. Oh my God.
Which explains a lot about the design of Space Invaders, which we'll get to,
right,
because
exactly.
He did have some input into its creation.
Yes. So maybe he had money to begin with. I mean, he couldn't have been poor because he is interacting with all of these elites of the Japanese, society going on in the invasion, the real invaders, not space invaders, land invaders. He's engaging with them and they're talking to him as somebody who can help them. So, I don't think he is a kind of penniless, refugee or something like that. He's someone who has some kind of pull and power to help and then is able to relocate himself again. So, obviously, he was either very good at business or had a good stake or whatever, but Taito launches and starts doing all sorts of stuff. I know there's Taito Vodka. Did you know about this?
think I knew about vodka,
but that's incredible.
Yes, yeah, Kogan. You know, he's of that, you know, that Ukrainian Russian sort of background. So vodka is, you know, his lifeblood. I'm assuming. And so Taito released, there's a Taito branded vodka. You can see there's a picture of a bottle of it on their website.
They need to bring that back. Like,
I know,
sell it at like Mega Rage in Mizunokuchi or something, where they have the bar and whatnot.
You put the invader on the bottle. Come on.
Exactly. And I think they were doing all sorts of import-export stuff, but then they fell into the jukebox. Like so many companies that we associate with video games, they fell in Japan. They fell into the kind of jukebox industry in Japan. Jukebox repair, jukebox import, because jukeboxes in that pre-karaoke era were the main source of automated, you know, music in Japanese cities at the time. So, and those like are real, like, by, you know, kids, if you've never seen a jukebox, I can't imagine anybody under the age of 60 is listening to this podcast, but these were like mechanical monstrosities that played records for like a dime or a quarter or something like that. And they needed a lot of service and repair and stuff like that. So that leads directly to their like electromechanical games and things, right?
Mm-hmm. Which they were one of the first Japanese companies that I'm aware of that was making electromechanical games. I think it was them, and what, Casco was another big one.
Right.
And they were, I think, the first Japanese company to take up making video games. They started off with like Pong clones and whatnot, of course. But
everybody did.
Well, everybody, you know, did that.
Can't one make an argument that, and I certainly have, that Space Invaders is basically a breakout clone? Like it's basically a breakout.
Admitted pretty much at this point.
Yeah. Well, Nishikado said as much.
The bricks are after you. That's the difference, mm-hmm. you know? And of course, that's another interesting connection, because of course, Breakout is Steve Wozniak's brainchild and Jobs' brainchild. So you have this like kind of indirect Apple connection going on here. It's just amazing, this web of connections behind the scenes.
Yeah. Jeremy and I did a Breakout episode a few years ago, which if you want more details on how that like came together and how that leads into Invaders, you know, we covered a lot of it. But yeah, Nishikado, he was one of their electromechanical game designers. He did some really popular early ones like Sky Fighter.
Right.
And then once they started getting into video games, he started doing a lot of transistor logic work, like he did Soccer, which is a Pong clone. He did Speed Race, which is a very early driving game. And unlike American driving games, which are really focused on simulation and the experience of driving, Speed Race is really built around speed and the sensation of going really fast. And that's really an early, I'd say, splitting point for racing games between Western and Japanese development. He came up with Western Gun, which was a fun little TTL game of two cowboys shooting at each other. Interceptor, which is a video game version of Sky Fighter. And a number of these were released in the U.S. And other parts of the world through Midway, which they had a little partnership with.
Yeah, we need to unravel that. Western Gun, I want to talk about for a second. I believe it was released, what was it released as in America? Gunfight or something like that?
So in the U.S., it was Gunfight. And
right.
It's like a completely different game with the vaguest similarities in that it's two cowboys shooting at each other.
Well, I remember being shocked when I went back and looked at Nishikado's version, because it's like two super deformed kawaii mascot cowboys trying to kill each other. And the American one are these like ugly giant like sprites. And, like, America was focused, and this actually I think is another kind of big, that's a big moment in a sense, because America was so focused on making reality in their games and failing at it over and over again. And it was always like centered like largely on these macho masculine pursuits like driving and shooting and like, you know, fighting and nuclear war and like all sorts of things. Cause there's nothing more manly than nuclear war, of course.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the Japanese quickly, I think, adapted to the fact that the you know, computers and or transistors of the day, you know, couldn't reproduce reality, and they had to kind of deform it, they had to stylize it, and there's a very haiku like nature in the kind of art they made within the limitations of those really, really, by our standards, primitive machines of the era, I think. And I think that's like a big turning point where games started to get cute. And certainly Space Invaders was a big jumping off point for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and gunfight is actually integral to the Space Invaders tale, which I find absolutely fascinating, because so Midway licenses Western Gun. They decide this is too cutesy to release in the West, as you were talking about. So they had a sort of a development studio nearby that they worked with a lot called Dave Nutting Associates. They asked Dave Nutting Associates, DNA, to rework this into a game that would appeal more to Western audiences, in their view.
Make it more violent. Make it more like people killing people. Kids love that.
Yeah.
Isn't that what cowboys do, after all?
So DNA went above and beyond with this. They decided to make this a CPU-based game, because that was a technology that they'd been experimenting with pinball machines. The Intel 8080 was available now, so they decided, let's try using a microprocessor. So Tom McHugh, the programmer, he redesigned this game around a microprocessor, and it plays very differently, I think is the best way to say it. Nishikado did not like the gunfight changes, shocker, but he felt that this really showed him that microprocessor technology was kind of where they needed to go with video games. It allowed for new types of games and scenarios than what this transistor technology really allowed for. And that sort of feeds into Space Invaders a little bit, because this is sort of the tech that he uses to develop that game. He couldn't get a development system from the U.S. because it was too expensive, so he just sort of imported all the parts piece by piece and taught himself how it all worked. And then separately, like you talked about Breakout and how Space Invaders was very much inspired by it.
Right.
And that's a very salient, because Breakout, it was popular in the U.S. It was probably the most popular game since Pong at that point. But it was a massive hit in Japan. Where Namco was the distributor.
And bootlegger,
because...
they're bootlegging their own game because they couldn't get enough from Atari. Isn't that the story?
Yeah. Namco had an agreement with Atari that they could sell the game there, but they had to only take machines that Atari could ship over there. And because the game was too popular, Atari couldn't keep up with demand. They were getting, like, inundated with clones. There's so many Breakout clones in Japan.
And we'll see kind of echoes of that later with Space Invaders, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, they ended up breaking their contract with Atari and just making their own units.
Steve Jobs once described the atmosphere at Atari as the smell of marijuana wafted freely through the air conditioning system. So, like, color me unsurprised that they were unable to ship enough units. They're probably, like, so high in there trying to, like, just, you know, clear another round of Breakout that they couldn't make enough for Japan. Although, like, I wonder, it's obvious when I was writing about this for my book, Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. I remember being struck by the fact of how, like, you know, nobody really thought of Japan as a market back then for games, or Japan was not on the map as a game maker. And it's obvious that the Atari guys just saw this as a totally secondary, like, oh, whatever these little people over there in their little country are going to do, that's fine. Almost a little, because, you know, Atari, even though they're named after a Japanese word, you know, they're the kings of video games at this point in the, like, 77, 78, 79 time frame. And I don't know, it's just interesting how, like, Japan really rose from nothing. Like, it's almost their game, like, you know, coming into their own as a game development powerhouse kind of mirrors the Japanese economy coming back after the war as a whole. They had nothing. Suddenly they're second largest economy in the world. Like, in the 70s, they have no video games. Suddenly they're, like, the second biggest producer, or even the biggest producer of video games in the world.
Yeah.
An interesting thing.
I was kidding before. You thought I was kidding. I'm not kidding. I feel like without Space Invaders, Japan might not exist as we know it. But getting back to the Breakout thing, I think that's really interesting to me, because I was a kid at the time. I would have known Breakout, and it's like I never put together the Breakout Space Invaders connection until decades later as an adult when someone pointed out that it's basically the same concept. I was like, I never thought of that.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. I didn't notice at all.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, Breakout, I think Breakout is probably the first real hit in Japan, in my opinion, because if you look back, almost every Japanese company that made games at that point tried their hand at some kind of block game or block kuzushi game. Mm-hmm. I know Nintendo had one that I think, Miyamoto design the case for that one? I think that was one of his early...
He might have designed the case, but it was, the designer of the engineer of the NES, Uemura-san.
Oh, okay.
Uemura-san is the one who actually designed the game. And he told me, he's like, yeah, we were just knocking off Pong. We're knocking off, you know.
Yeah, the industrial design everything. For the home version was Miyamoto, though, yes. But,
yeah, the actual physical case, that makes sense. I mean, he's like the Johnny Ives of of Nintendo of the era. But, like, Nintendo is, like, the most copycat company on the planet in the late 70s.
But also SNK. SNK also had a very early block game that I don't know if it still exists, but... there are flyers for it at the very least. So we know that SNK had a early block breaking game of some kind, but their first real hit would be Ozma Wars, which is a Space Invaders clone. Yeah. Yep. You know it.
Yeah. Yeah. What's fascinating to me about Breakout in Japan is that this is what popularized the tabletop cabinet format.
Right.
And that basically sets the game into a table. These were really popular in places that you wouldn't have a stand-up machine, like cafes or restaurants or tea shops, bathhouses, etc. So,
I love to play some Breakout after it, rub down at the bathhouse.
Right? So this is extremely relevant for Space Invaders because guess what game really took off in the tabletop format in Japan? Space Invaders.
Yeah.
Invader rooms. There were entire rooms devoted to Space Invaders.
So yeah, Breakout was a huge hit. Nishikado, of course, saw it, and he thought it was really interesting because he had seen its antecedent, which was Ramtech's Clean Sweep. I think Taito might have actually published that in Japan. He thought that one was really boring because it's like a paddle ball game where you're hitting balls on a screen like dots, like Pac-Man, but it's not particularly interesting, he felt. But Breakout, he thought... okay, you don't need to have, like, fancy graphics. This is an extremely simple-looking game. It's not realistic in the slightest, but it's really compelling, and I can use this. I can noodle on this.
Right.
And then, finally, he also saw Midway Seawolf, which is another microprocessor game, and that's what sort of was the catalyst of him, like, okay, I'm going to figure out how this works. I'm going to make my own microprocessor game.
Also, to make it all about my kids again, I have to say I saw Seawolf a few years back at the Seattle Pinball Museum. Once I got my kids to that thing, they could not stop playing Seawolf. So that is another all-timer.
It's a great game.
Yeah.
I feel like it's mostly like overlooked now because there's so many other games, but it's awesome. It's
got the
really
scope.
Fun.
You're looking through the scope. Love it.
Yeah, that scope. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was actually, I don't know if it inspired it directly, but Battlezone. Remember the tank game?
I remember that. Yeah.
The periscope kind of thing. So those, you know, back, you know, you still see them today, but those kind of game experiences where they had some immersive element to them, where you felt like you were in it. Like, you know, Sega was the master of that in the 80s with, like, you're on a motorcycle when you're playing Super Hang-On or whatever, but it's, yeah, no, I love those kind of like those sculpted cabinets and things like that.
They really harken back to like the electromechanical games. Like I think Seawolf is on some level a remake of Periscope, which was the big hit of like 1969 or so.
Well, when I was researching for the book, I found this 1947 article about an arcade. I think it was in Chicago where the guy repurposed like B-29 gun turrets and turned them into some kind of like electromechanical shooting game in his arcade.
Sounds about right.
It wasn't even an arcade back then. I don't even know. Did pinball exist in 47?
Yeah. I don't remember if it was necessarily like the flipper pinball, but pinball as like a concept, it goes back a long time.
Pachinko? American Pachinko? Is that what we'll call this? But anyway, yeah, there's like the physicality of those EM games is something I think that early arcade games really had to struggle against. I think a lot of them didn't feel as immersive because they were just on a screen, you know? And until the gameplay and the characters and all of that and the music started to catch up, which they did with Space Invaders, I think, you know, it was really kind of a neck and neck sort of thing, a competition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, and I say this as someone who lives here, leave it to Chicago to make a game out of repurposed gun turrets.
Who else would do it? Yeah, that sounds like something Chicago Coin would have done.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the Chicago way.
All I want to do is have some deep dish pizza and then go play with my B-29 exactly. turret. It's all I want to do.
It's what we all do, even now.
Yep. Exactly.
So yeah, Nishikado, he built his own development system. He had to program everything directly using like a chart of hexadecimal code and assembly language, which sounds nightmarish.
Yes.
But this was probably why this game took so long to develop. So from Breakout, he took the screen clearing aspect, the vertical format, and the two-wave design of Breakout. It's like once you finish the second wave, the game's over. He changed that to endless waves. And then he's like, well, players will see who can get furthest in this game, right? That'll be the big point of competition. And then, you know, the paddle became a gun, and the wall became moving targets. It's a shooting gallery, right? And then the targets start shooting back.
Right. Yeah, it is. There's a shooting gallery aspect to it too. I never really thought about that. And that's actually a really popular sort of game in Japan. It's called shateki. Mm-hmm. You'll see it at like, you know, fairs, festivals, you know, matsuri, things like that, where there'll be a booth and you shoot like a cork gun at little like objects or prizes, and if you knock them over, you get to win them. So you know, Japanese people were very familiar with this like shoot at things, you know, for win prizes sort of aspect as well. I think that's an interesting connection.
Yeah. And the fact that they were able to shoot back was, you know, pretty unusual. If you look at pre-Space Invaders shooting games, generally they are more like electromechanical or more physical shooting game, where they just sort of hang around and maybe move around a bit, but they don't really fight back. And if they do fight back in one of these early video games, all they really cost you is time, because there's no real concept of lives at that point.
Well, they say time is the fourth dimension. So, you know, that is a big thing to lose.
Yeah, that's true. So, this did originally have a military theme, like Nishikado's Interceptor and Sky Fighter. But he was having trouble figuring out, okay, what can we put in here that you shoot at? Like, I can't make things move like very smoothly with this tech. They sort of move jerkily, so tanks don't really look good. Neither do planes and ships.
Isn't it true that Michael Kogan was not did not want to see military themes? You know, probably for the very reason that he was fleeing the militaries of various kinds for much of his early life, and not even not so early, like well into his 20s. I can imagine not wanting to put military themes in games.
I think it was explicitly people shooting people and not necessarily like military themes in general is how I remember it, but I could be a little off on that.
Cowboys aren't people.
I was thinking back to the cowboy thing. I was like, but how did they do that? So, I mean, I don't know. There are holes, or maybe there are games he didn't see or something. I don't know.
In that case, they're like very cartoony.
It looks like it's like Dig Dug with guns.
Yeah.
You know, not Pokemon with guns. It's Dig Dug with guns. Don't they look like that? I thought they did.
Yeah. Kogan, from what I understand, was the specific person who was like, no, we're not going to have soldiers marching around because I don't want you shooting troops. Which is funny because this is the same company that would, you know, a few years later release like Frontline, where you are a soldier shooting a bunch of other soldiers. Yeah.
Oh my god. I got to dump so many quarters into that. And then it's kind of the prototype for Ikari Warriors, I guess, isn't
it? Yeah, and Commando and that whole genre.
I mean, you had the rotary controller, which is the bane of my existence for emulation these days, because you really can't play those games without a rotary controller. Somebody finally released one.
I've heard mixed things about it, but and I've not gotten one myself yet, but yeah, I plan to experiment with that because that was the thing for so long, right? It's like I can't accurately do this. Like, you can play it as a twin stick game in some cases, but like you lose something in doing that. Like it's maybe an acceptable substitute, but it's not quite right.
Kogan
went back on his word. I guess, you know, when the money starts coming in, you know. Although actually, wait a second, because Kogan died very young. He died in his early 60s on a business trip to the United States. He had a heart attack. Like, it was completely unexpected. I mean, I don't know if anybody expects
heart attacks. I think he lasted longer than Frontline, but I could be wrong.
Frontline, I think,
that
is like 82 or something.
84 is when he passed away. So.
Yes, he passed away in 84, and his son took over. And that's another whole story, because he was involved in all of this crazy, crazy stuff running Taito Brazil. And ended up fleeing the country after a kidnapping extortion attempt.
Wow.
Just wild, wild stuff.
Too much of that Taito vodka.
Yeah, too much of that Taito. So he takes over the company in name only. Actually, like a Japanese exec, much older in his 60s, ends up running Taito for the 80s. And I think his name was Abraham. Abraham leaves, or he was already in Brazil at the time, running Taito Brazil, which was doing a huge business in supplying Central America, South America with pinball games, early arcade games, and things like that. There's famously actually a large Japanese population or Japanese descent population in Brazil, but he gets extorted and kidnapped and extorted, like, by his own employees. Like two of his own executives or something like that, manages to escape and flees back. And now he fled basically to Monaco, where he lives now. He lives in Monaco, where he collects and races vintage, like, Ferraris and things like that. I was like, wow, how do I get a chunk of this Taito fortune?
What a life.
But like, what a life, literally. And he's still around. We should track him down, like, if we can catch him in one of those, like, super speedy little, like, Ferrari things. But he's still around. So the passing, I'm sure the passing of Kogan in 84 changed things at Taito. It probably put it, like, pretty firmly into Japanese hands at that point, you know, if it hadn't been already. Do you know what I mean? Like, being run that way. So, I mean, wow, that was way off. That was way off. Sorry. We went from Space Invaders to extortions, armed robberies, car racing.
This is the Taito story, man.
Yes.
Well, there's a book to be written here for sure. If you could pull the people together. I mean, it's basically like Tokyo Vice, but with pinball games and vodka.
And Space Invaders.
And Space Invaders. Yes. Little squid-like aliens.
Time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Anyway, so we're already like 45 minutes into this and we haven't even touched on the socio-cultural phenomenon, like what a huge thing Space Invaders was in Japan. It really was a game changer, if I might say.
Mm-hmm. You could say that. So I'll run through a few things here. So the space theme, it came from him seeing Star Wars advertising posters in 78.
Not Star Wars. He saw the advertising.
Yeah, he didn't watch the movie.
Yeah, we have to emphasize
this. Nobody did.
We have to emphasize this just for, you know, it's a very different era. It took over a year for Star Wars to make the journey from America to Japan. It opened in June 1978, which by all accounts, Space Invaders was already playable and out by the time the movie opened. So he based his Star Wars impressions on, like, magazine covers and advertisements. It's like, oh,
yes.
Star Wars, that sounds interesting. Like, he had no idea what the movie was about or what was in it. Just like, well, outer space, I guess that's important. So yeah. I just find that so hilarious because, you know, at this point in time, anything Star Wars is a global simultaneous release. You know, it is available digitally the very same second in every country. But when this happened, it was like, no. You know, a full year, a child could be conceived and born in the time it took from Star Wars to get open in May to open in June.
Yep.
And knockoff movies were being made based on what people assumed Star Wars was like. You had these like tokusatsu live action films. You had like Message from Space, Patrick Macias's favorite movie of all time, my partner in crime from the Pure Tokyo Show podcast. You had Star Wolf endlessly parodied on MST3K and other shows. Yep. Like these really, really like bargain basement, like kind of knockoffs of Star Wars. And I think, you know, people always kind of assume that Space Invaders was a knockoff, but I don't see it as a knockoff of Star Wars. I see it as very much inspired by, cut from the same cloth as that kind of global, whatever you want to call it, wavelength that was happening at that time.
Yeah. He was like, oh, space theme. Great. I'll do that.
Space.
And,
right.
And then, you know, the aliens, they were just like little sea creatures because Japan, and you know, he saw War of the Worlds when he was a kid and was like, oh, hey, that's a cool idea.
Yeah, I was so surprised to hear that because I just recently saw that movie for the first time, the 50s movie, I should say. Obviously, that story has been adapted many times, but specifically the 50s version, which was a color film, obviously it got a lot of play in many countries. So to hear that Nishikado saw that movie when he was a kid and it stuck with him, because you don't really get to see the aliens that much in that movie. It's mostly about their spaceships, but you do see some tentacles at the end when they're all dying from the disease. Spoilers. And, you know.
What? I still haven't seen it, man. I've been waiting. I've been waiting 60 years. You finally screwed me on this. God. Okay, sorry. Continue.
But yeah, I can see that. I can see that lasting in someone's mind. Like, oh my God, what if squids came from space? And he said, okay, what if squids come from space, but this time you shoot them down before they land? Aha.
Mm-hmm.
I have a gun. I have a gun. I can shoot these space squids. I have a gun. What is it? What is it? This is the big question. That gun platform at the bottom, it's like a rectangle with like a little triangle on top. Like,
it's like it's like a little turret, right?
Is it a spaceship? There's a European band called Royskop, and they have a song called Happy Up Here, where they recreate Space Invaders on the streets of whatever European city it is. And they're using a car, like with lights all over it, that's driving back and forth with a gun on its roof and like shooting at these like, it's obviously CG, these invaders that are coming down. And I was like, yeah, man, it's a sedan. It's a car. That's what it is. And we'll have to link to it. It's actually a great video. It's a great song, but it's 100% Space Invaders influenced. Royskop.
I believe in the infamous Futurama interpretation of Space Invaders, I believe it's like a tank that's got treads going back and forth. And he's like,
that could work.
Fries
that
inside of it, shooting upwards with his, with his Walkman and his soda.
I think that's what they did with some of the later sequels to the game, and they had more fidelity.
Right. It's funny you say Walkman, though, because it came out the year before the Walkman did. So, like, these are, like, two intertwined phenomena. I mean, look, we're still wearing headphones today. You know what I mean? If I'm ever fighting the aliens, I'm definitely going to be using, like, a Walkman-style thing when I'm doing it.
Yeah, you got to listen to your Rush.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he's programming this really for the first time, and he's looking for different shortcuts. So, like, he designs the game around the invaders speeding up as they go through. He doesn't have to program that. He just like, okay, well, the processor can't move this many invaders all that quick. I'll just use that to my advantage and not have to waste time writing code. The UFOs, like we talked about, they're not randomly scored. It's just, it's based on your shot count, because that was something you could do really easily. And because of this is one of the factors that leads to this becoming like a real high score chasing game, as well as the decision to, you know, take from Seawolf the idea of like a high score being shown at the top of the screen. He added some barriers to block shots, make it a little more difficult.
Was this the first game where you really, like, you know, the competition was kind of against the machine for the highest score? You know, as opposed to like just trying to kick your friend's ass at Pong and having like more, you know, scores against them.
I feel like it's one of the first. If I don't remember Seawolf well enough to know if that's like a good comparison point, but considering this one doesn't have a time limit and you just keep going until you die, I'd say that, yeah, this is probably the first real score chasing competition game.
Which, I mean, also explains why it blew up the way it did, as far as like having entire, you know, early arcades dedicated to it, right? Like, if that had been a real well-established thing beforehand, would it have had quite that effect?
Mm-hmm.
So there is an amazing, amazing, I don't know if it's been subtitled, it probably should be, a vintage Japanese TV special, like the equivalent of 60 Minutes. And it's called, like, Noisy Invaders Are Attacking Japanese Cities. And it's all, that's the rough translation of the title. And, you know, you have this, you know, your reporter in a trench coat, I'm heading out into the city at these invader rooms. The thing that was really interesting about this piece, and I think adds some context to this, is that it was, Space Invaders was specifically explained in this news piece, mass media news piece, as being a rival, not to video games, but to pachinko.
Oh,
and it was taking the 100 yen coins that should have been going into pachinko and putting them into these game things instead, which pachinko, as you may or may not know, is intimately associated with organized crime in Japan. And they were not particularly happy about this. And when you're talking about pachinko or you're talking about video games, you're really basically talking about a real estate business. It's where do you put this piece of machinery in a place where it's going to get the most passerby, the most users, the most players. So the, you know, obviously as they see their revenues decreasing in this one vice, they take an interest in this other one. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole, you know, there's a lot of those invader rooms were in places like the Red Light District, Kabukicho, and places like that, Shinjuku, things like that. And it's a really interesting sort of, you see these crossing of all sorts of cultural streams in Japanese society because this game is so addictive and simple and fun and anybody can do it. But it was very much an adult experience. You and I, you know, Diamond and I were talking about playing it as little kids. No kids played Space Invaders in 1978 or 1979. And like the only kids who did were like delinquents who were like sneaking into these really, really skeevy establishments where your mom, your PTA, your youth pastor, your Shinto youth pastor did not want you. There aren't Shinto youth pastors. I just made that up. Just didn't want you in there. And actually there were in a lot of places, the PTAs would actually try to intercept kids going into those.
Yeah, that's sort of what led to the end of that invader boom. We're jumping ahead a little bit, but
sorry, I keep blowing up your narrative. I'm sorry. I keep talking about extortions, yakuza, vodka.
It's all good.
But this is perfect, Matt, because honestly, what we really now, what we need now is the yakuza minus zero, or minus one, I guess. So find out what were they doing Kabukicho in like 1979 and like have a side quest where you have to either, you know, break up an invader room or start your own invader room. And then, of course, you know, if you pay Taito some money, you can play Space Invaders inside the yakuza game, which is where it should be.
Well, not naming any names, this is actually one of the big problems with writing histories of the Japanese game industry circa late 70s, 80s, up until about the 90s. So many of the companies that we associate with beloved children's franchises today had one or perhaps both feet and maybe arms and body and head too in the underworld. And we're getting money from the underworld and we're making money from the underworld and giving kickbacks to the underworld. And so video game, I'm not going to, like, literally I was warned, do not look too deeply into this when I started prying into the backgrounds of certain games. I'm not talking Space. I don't think Taito was one of these, but you know, when you're in a quarter-based, a cash-based business, real estate-based business,
it's going to come up.
80s Japan, I mean, like every company, that's why they have these rules now in Japan where literally even a small company like mine, you have to sign these affidavits that say you aren't doing business with the organized crime. You don't have any organized crime ties. And I always laugh when I'm signing these. I'm like, yeah, Matt Alt, known Yakuza associate. You know, it's like, but it was a really, really big problem in the 80s where even like respected companies would have to do business with these guys. And I don't know how respected the video game business was back then. So like, they're not really respected business. So that's another, aspect of this whole thing.
Yeah. With, I'll jump ahead real quick, since I know you have to go soon. There is this, whole thing, the invader boom really ended in June 79, very abruptly, because the All Japan Amusement Park Association, which was the industry trade organization for, you know, coin-op games and whatnot, they realized that if they didn't rein this game in with all of the seedy stuff going on, the government would start issuing new laws and regulations that would do it for them, and they didn't want that. So
Which did end up happening.
It did eventually happen.
Years later.
Yeah. So they bought some time, like 6 years or so. But they had a directive that limited Invader games to locations in areas that had an attendant and parental accompaniment for anyone under 15 that was playing the game. And if you were under 18, you could not enter those game centers anyway. So
in that same that was being talked about in that same news story that I was talking about. But one of the single most shining moment in that is where they start interviewing people who are knocking off Space Invaders, because there's a lot, as I'm sure we're going to get into this. There's a lot of it's a pretty simple thing. Once you see how it's done, there's a bunch of companies who are making these not even, they're just, some of them are just pure knockoffs. Like they copy the transistor layouts and things like that. Those are in Japan known as dead copy games.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a problem for all sorts of games up through the 80s and stuff like that. Others took a little bit more of a creative approach. One of those was a company called Nintendo. And Nintendo's, did I say that or just think it? Nintendo's then president, Mr. Yamauchi, goes on this program and makes this impassioned speech about how video game mechanics should not be patentable or copyrightable because
a
rising tide lifts all ships. When one game company makes an awesome game like mechanic, we should all be free to copy it and use it because that's democracy, man. That's what it's all about. You know, record scratch, fast forward to like Nintendo's first lawsuit against somebody for like, poaching. But it's on tape. It's probably actually on film. It's like, this is like a 1978 interview, but he's in this all white suit. He looks like Bob Guccione from Penthouse magazine. He's got these like kind of semi tinted glasses and he's like, yeah, game mechanics. Who could patent something like that? It's the world's heritage. It's the game industry's heritage.
It's funny because, up until about 82, that was the legal argument. Like, there was no copyright protection in Japan for video games until a court case ruling came down in 82 that said, in December, I think, that was like, no, video games are subject to copyright protections, and therefore, you cannot have an unlicensed clone. That is illegal.
Also, I'm pretty sure Yamauchi didn't even understand what a game mechanic was.
There's also that.
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm sure he's like got his like the penguin. He's got his cigarette in its holder. He's like, games. The future's in games. That's what they tell me. Games.
I'm sure.
Mechanics. I don't understand these things.
Shogi's in there, right?
I'm sure Yamauchi's head, when he thinks game mechanic, he thinks about Gunpei Yokoi, the guy who fixes all his games. That's the game mechanic.
Yes, exactly. Yep. He thinks that Gunpei Yokoi is like, you know, Looney Tunes. What is that extendable arm thing, the ultra hand. What a game. Actually, I think Yamauchi's idea of a game is the game of Go. Bunch of stones on a piece of wood.
Isn't he definitely understood the mechanics of that.
I'm just picturing him like, you know, mentally picturing the song Powerhouse and someone in a factory like fixing these EM machines.
I remember when I interviewed Nintendo's I'm blanking on his name, the engineer who
Uemura?
Made the Uemura.
Yes.
When I interviewed Uemura, he told me that Nintendo purchased a bunch of Space Invader game cabinets and brought them into the offices so that they could study them. With the purpose, obviously, of copying them. And, you know, Uemura said that it infected the company for several weeks where, like, everybody was playing the game. Nobody's taking notes. Nobody's doing anything to the point where, like, they had to, like, actually unplug the damn things because they were, like, they were messing up Nintendo at the time. And that's what Uemura's like, there's something to this, you know. I think he said he was just mad that he hadn't come up with it or they hadn't come up with it. That was like the idea. But like, invaders invaded Nintendo circa 1978, 9. I'm off topic again. Sorry.
I do have to give credit to the soundscape of Space Invaders, because that was not done by Nishikado. That was done by Michiyuki Kame, who had recently graduated university. He has said that he wanted to harken back to the Jaws theme to create tension. I think did a good job with there.
Yeah.
I also want to note that the name came from Kazunari Tajima, who worked in Taito's export division. Nishikado does not like the Space Invaders theme. He still doesn't like the name. He wanted to call it Space Monster.
An awesome name.
Which is an awesome name.
But not as, I don't think it has the pull of Space Invaders.
But it's more thematic with the art on the cabinet.
Sure.
Which you have to give it that, which was done by Kazuo Nakagawa, who he envisioned this as like a battle on the moon, as a last stand against the invaders. It's kind of cool. Interestingly, apparently the game initially also included a tilt sensor, similar to like a pinball machine, so that if you
got too
mad and like shoved it around, it would cost you your entire game.
You're trying to tilt those pixels? Like if you tilt right? the game,
yeah,
like your shot will arc?
it's wild.
Well, I don't think people realize these, like there was obviously a subset of people who probably didn't realize these things were happening inside a TV. You know what I mean?
Maybe.
Like, these things, they probably thought there was some kind of electromechanical thing going on.
Is this a portal to another world?
Exactly.
And it's really funny, like, we've talked about how this game was like a huge exploded hit and a cultural icon, and nobody saw it coming, because when they first debuted this on June 16th, 78, at a distributor show, they showed it alongside Blue Shark, which was another game that no one remembers or cares about.
I love this.
And nobody there thought it was going to be much of a hit. They're like, Blue Shark, that's going to be the big hit, right? Like,
that was the winner.
It's got like a time-based game. It's like what we're used to. Space Invaders, this is life-based. It's too hard. No one's going to like be able to play this. No one's going to want to spend money on it. So they only sold 500 units at that distributor show, mostly to its own locations and like long-standing distributors who were just like, "Well, we want to keep a good relationship with Taito, so we'll buy your game. That's probably going to, you know, completely bomb."
The dark secret, this is actually just an example of this, like one of many. Nobody knows what's going to be a hit. Like looking back, you're like, "Yeah, Space Invaders, Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, yeah."
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has any idea. Even the people I've interviewed, like Uemura thought the NES was going to be the Famicom was going to be a failure. Everybody has no idea. Nobody has any idea. It's not luck, because there's some kind of like mojo happening where like you get this kind of, you know, organic traction going on, but anybody who says they can predict it is trying to sell you something, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And my favorite part of this story is that Nishikado remembered that the moment that he realized, oh, this game's actually going to take off, is once it started hitting like cafes and other kinds of venues. And he had to go out, or not he had to go out, they sent a technician, like they weren't going to send him to do this, but someone had a cabinet that was busted after like a little under a month, and they went to go open it up, only to find that the coin box had overflowed, similar to, you know, how Atari's like Pong story, you know, the prototype broke because
and that happened with Donkey Kong later too.
Yeah. They're like, oh, we have a hit. So
yes.
By September, this game was a runaway success. They could not keep up with production to meet the demand, and which is why you got so many friggin' clones. And I want to put these numbers out there because they are insane. So Breakout, that was a huge hit for Atari, right? That sold around 11,000, 15,000 units in the U.S. Taito sold, by the end of 78, 100,000 Space Invaders cabinets just in Japan. And like most coin-op machines do not have that kind of production run, and that wasn't even the whole production run for this game. I think it wound up somewhere closer to I think the estimate number is somewhere between 230 and 280,000 in Japan, just Japan, and you know, 200,000 or so was just Taito and the companies that officially licensed with them to make clones or production. Yeah, Diamond, go ahead.
Just, I want to think, like, all of us are old enough to remember Street Fighter II. Think about how many places you saw Street Fighter II. I'm pretty sure Street Fighter 2 maxed out at about 50,000 cabs, maybe 60, yeah. Like that. And that was a massive hit that completely refreshed arcades. But this is in the 70s, late 70s, in one country, 100,000 yeah. machines.
It's
where they're packing them everywhere, wherever any place you can get a table where you can serve drinks and two seats, put it in there.
Physical distribution, not digital.
Yeah.
Like you had to make these things, you had to ship them around and stuff like that. And I'm sure we're also going to touch on the fact that there was a shortage of 100 yen coins.
That did happen.
At the time. It did happen. You know, I had a first thought. So like that was taken as it was a rumor going around that the Japanese mint had to like make more 100 yen coins because they're all getting sucked into these machines. Later, I heard that was an exaggeration. And then later after that, I heard, nope, it wasn't an exaggeration. It really did happen. It makes sense. I mean, it's tough for Americans to understand, I think, how much this just obsessed Japanese society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it 100 yen was a lot of money at the time. It's way more than a quarter. It was like, you know, now it's like now it's gotten cheaper again because the yen is so weak against the dollar. But I remember the first time I came to Japan in 1990, I was like, 100 yen? Why can't I spend 25 yen on a game? It is a lot, which is, yes.
Yeah, the Japanese Diet, like their legislators, had to negotiate directly with Taito to get these coins back into circulation more quickly than they like otherwise would have, which is wild. And yeah, they had to increase production for a couple of months in 79. So yeah, so Taito can't keep up with demand. They've licensed out to a few different companies because there's so many other companies making bootlegs. You've got Sega, you've got Nintendo, Data East, Konami, Universal, Osaka World Vending, a company that did not survive the Invader shakeout.
Osaka World Vending. That's the first time I've heard that one.
They had World Invaders, and they got completely destroyed once the bottom fell out of this. The licensed companies include SNK, Sammy, Logitech, IPM, rebranded as IRM. I think it's a different Logitech.
Okay.
I hope it's a different Logitech.
Because I think that's why today when you buy mouse or keyboard or whatever in Japan, it's called Logic Cool. Because I think that's a different Logitech is something else.
I did not even realize that.
I think that makes sense. I think that's what happened, yeah.
And what was the other company? Jatra, yeah. Jatra Invaders or whatever the heck it was called. So those were all like licensed officially through Taito. See, SNK, they bootlegged the heck out of Breakout, but you know, Space Invaders, they were doing you a solid.
Until they made Osmo Wars.
Well, you know, that was the other fun thing is that once this game, like once the bottom fell out of the Invader market, you had all of these boards. What were you going to do with them? You were going to have to come up with other games that use that hardware. And so you get Osmo Wars.
Yeah.
And Brian, you have an anecdote in here.
Yeah,
this was actually
from the book that came with the Space Invaders Invincible Collection. So this was from a direct Nishikado interview. His mother ran a dagashiya, which is you could probably talk for a while about what a dagashiya actually is, but it's like small candy stores that you see a lot in, maybe not exclusively, but in more kind of like slightly more rural areas. I feel like you associate them with mostly that sell like sort of cheap candy.
There's one in my neighborhood. It's kind of like a dagashiya / convenience store.
These days they've probably quote unquote evolved a little bit from like your classic image of them. But this is in Kishiwada City in the Osaka area. And she asked if Nishikado could get her one for the store. And Nishikado went to the executive director of sales at Taito to see if they would sell him one directly. But of course, at this time, like cabinets were insanely hard to get. This was during a massive shortage where they couldn't even keep up with, you know, demand from everyone. But because presumably because he was the man who created the game, the director made a special exception for him and let Nishikado's mother put it in the store. And what ended up happening is that they were so hard to get that people would see it and complain, wondering how in the world some tiny little store got a cabinet when no one else could.
Well, I hope she put up a big sign saying, "My son made this. Fuck off."
And then they'd be like, "Sure, okay. Of course he did, lady."
I assume that she absolutely like bragged about this the entire time this game was booming.
And I remember him saying, like, when they were talking to her about it, like, she would kind of, like, rag me a little, being like, but you made the game! You have to be able to get one!
They're closing in on me. Dark forces, cold and unseen.
We talked about the score chasing aspect of this game, and like there was a lot of coverage of people chasing scores in this, even in the US. Like some of the earliest coverage of coin op game spaces were of players like trying to get the high score on Space Invaders. There's like I should have put his name in here. There's this Hawaiian player who was super good in the late 70s at Space Invaders, and he's been dubbed as one of the early pro gamers, quote unquote, even though I don't think he ever made a dime.
And he went for like hours and hours, didn't he? In like a straight session.
I'm going to say at least an hour.
Yeah.
He definitely rolled the score a few times, which is admittedly something you could do in, what, 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah, if someone who's rolled the score over a couple of times myself, like it is not impossible.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take a super, super long time.
I actually looked it up. So at this point, the official record, at least via Twin Galaxies, is 218,870 points by an Australian guy, John Tannehill. And
That sounds right.
According to the records, it took him 3 hours and 48 minutes to get that score.
He's the guy I was thinking of, I think.
That is extremely... That's a hard nut to crack.
Yeah. Right. And obviously, that's the official line via Twin Galaxies. If you go on YouTube, you can see longer playthroughs that go to even higher scores, which are emulated, which are not included in the official records. But yeah,
right. There
are people out there who can play this game for many, many hours at a time to get even higher scores above the official high score. But yeah, that's the numbers we're talking about here.
It's funny because Nishikado programmed in 8 distinct waves, and each new wave, the invaders are start a lower down. One line. No one in testing could get past the fifth wave. So he's like, okay, well, this isn't going to be a big deal. We'll have the high score, but it's not like it's going to roll or anything. And then, you know, not too long after the game came out, the Nagoya attack methodology was discovered. And in the US, it's known by the much darker names like Wall of Death or Execution Method. And the concept here is that there's a bug in the game where if the invaders are on the very last row, like right above your cannon, their shots will just go through you. There's no hitbox. And because of this, you can carve open a window in their ranks and just hunt UFOs. And once you know that the UFOs are on a shot counter, you can always time it so that when they fly by, it's a 300-point UFO. So you can score a lot of points, and all you have to do is make sure you keep the invaders in check and are really good at hitting that last one that's going really fast.
Yeah.
I personally love this story because I feel like to this day, this is like one of the very few things that Nagoya is famous for. So I really, I'm glad they have this, you know, they deserve it.
Well, the funny thing is there are, I mean, based on obviously, there are slight variation. Like there's a Kyoto Uchi, for example. It's like, it's not super, super different from the Nagoya Uchi, but it's like, oh no, you put the hole here instead of here or whatever. And it's like, presumably wherever the person who came up with it is from is where they named it after.
Right. But Kyoto has so much, Brian.
Oh, Kyoto has a lot. Yeah. Kyoto, Nagoya like, needs a win.
You could go to Kyoto. You could go to Kyoto and spend an entire week there and you wouldn't be tired of all the stuff. But like,
Nagoya is the one that people remember in this case is the important part.
They needed love. They needed it.
Yes.
They should be like the epicenter of Space Invaders competitions today. Yes. That could be their new claim to fame. They could be the esports.
Their official prefectural mascot. It's a Space Invader now.
Like, you've got the esports World Cup in Saudi Arabia. This could be the Space Invaders World Cup in Nagoya. Just saying. Throwing that out there. Make it happen, guys.
I'll travel to Nagoya for that.
There you go. So Nishikado really thought he was going to get in trouble for this bug because they did not find it until the game was already out and popular. But since people thought it was cool and it was still making a crap load of money, his bosses were like, it's fine. Let's roll with it.
And I would argue, like, would the score chasing for that game even have become what it was if that bug hadn't existed? I would actually say no, because it's like, it really gives you a way, like, if you practice, you can reliably reproduce results because of it.
Do we have any record of who thought up the idea of shooting through the shield? Because I feel like that was also, like, when I found out about that, I was, like, way past the era of actually playing Space Invaders. But, like, when I heard about that, I was like, oh, wow, I never thought to do that.
I mean, obviously, it's Philip J. Fry.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Fair.
Yeah, I have no idea if that's been recorded anywhere. And, yeah, like, this game got its own strategy guide. This is the first game that had a strategy guide. In the U.S., it was released a year later as How to Win at Space Invaders, but in 79, it was released as How to Win Tech Invaders, with the Japanese title that I'm not going to bother trying to read.
There's a really famous British novelist who wrote that Space Invaders guide. Martin Amis?
It's a separate guide.
Oh, okay.
The British one did exist, too. And let me tell you, that came up so many times when I was trying to buy this copy.
Well, it's funny because Amis is like one of he's like one of the kind of leading lights of the British literary scene of that era. And he kind of disavowed this book. It was called Invasion of the Space Invaders, An Addict's Guide to Battle Tactics, Big Scores, and the Best Machines. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a really amazing portrait of what the Invaders craze was like in Britain at that time. Much recommended.
Yeah, that's a good perspective to take into this. I know it was huge in Europe because Midway did a lot of business over there with it. But you mostly hear about it from Japan's perspective, not even the U.S.
America's. Yeah, the U.S. But yeah, it was big in Britain, huge in Britain.
Another terrible title, though. Invasion of the Invaders. Get the fuck out of
that
here.
That is pretty bad.
I'm sorry. Excuse my French. But come on. Come on. If you're in England, especially, you gave us English. Do work harder. Use a synonym.
But like, yeah, we talked a little bit about with Osmo Wars when the Invader hangover hit and they let all this hardware stock, like the games they made to use that. Yeah, some of these were actually pretty interesting games that used the similar hardware. Like Konami made Astro Invader, which I think Stern licensed in the U.S. I think it was their first video game.
Stern of Berserk fame.
That's right. And like Astro Invader, pretty cool game. Taito made Lupin the Third, which
oh my God.
That's right.
And we're not talking about that like Laserdisc game.
This is not really a maze chase game, but it's kind of.
Yeah.
There's also like Lunar Rescue, Polaris. What's the other one? Space Cyclone, I think, uses the Invader hardware. Like they had a lot of Space Invaders stock to work
and
through.
Can we also pour out on the curb, so to speak, for all of those little handheld knockoffs and things like that? Epoch, all of these companies made little like LCD Invader games and things like that. In fact, I played probably as much on a little, I don't know what the company was. It was this like little Space Invader clone. Like battery powered standalone LCD game that I did in the arcades. I mean, it was a very easy. It was a game mechanic. Oh, there's that word that Yamauchi loves
so
much. It was a game mechanic that was easy to copy, and it was easy to replicate in non CPU, but non video game style form. What am I trying to say here? Not drawn on a TV screen, but actually like an LCD screen or something, or even like plastic. There were all of these like Tomy, I think, was making these kind of physical Space Invader kind of games that were almost like there was a sort of electromechanical sort of feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This game did get a lot of, interesting like clones and ports to like portable ones. I know Epic had the TV Vader. That was their their console version. And as far as I'm aware, this was like the first home console version of Space Invaders in Japan, except for maybe the Atari one, which we'll get to a little later. And that thing is it's interesting. It's got 48 invaders, but you only see 8 at a time because the hardware is not very good. You only see the bottom most ones in all the columns.
And the other problem, I mean, this is maybe making too broad of a statement, but like if you get into this game for the score, you will very quickly find that most of the knockoffs don't observe any of those same rules at all. And so, like, if you're doing things like Nagoya Uchi or whatever, you often can't do them in a lot of the clones. So, like, you got to play it straight, whatever that means.
People approach this with such rigor. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were so serious about it. Like, this is life and death, this battle against the invaders. Oh, man, here's the one I had, Entex. Entex is Super Space Invaders.
Oh, yeah, Entex. People could play. Entex was great. I have their Galaxian one, and that one's a great piece of work.
It sounds like some kind of, like, sanitary hygienic product, but Entex, they did produce quite a few games of my youth.
I will say this for TV Vader. They did actually have a shot counter set up for the UFO. Since it wasn't random.
That's convenient.
And it wasn't like a set. It also doesn't match the shot counter of the arcade game.
Boo.
But if you look at the manual, it does tell you, like, the point values for each shot. So you still have the experience. It's just not the same experience.
Can I just add, and you can feel free to cut this in wherever you want, there's actually a place in Tokyo where you can experience a retro-style Invader room now. It's in Nakano Broadway.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
And it was a little coffee shop, and about a year and a half ago or so, it's run by the company Kai Kai Kiki, which is the company that manages all of Superflat, Takashi Murakami's art stuff. And they replicated it down to, like, they had linoleum printed that has that kind of the floral pattern that was on the rugs of these places. They put in, like, all of that dark wood paneling, the light fixtures and things like that. It's not all Invader games, but it is probably the closest thing in atmosphere to an Invader room, minus the carcinogenic cigarette smoke that was, I'm sure,
was
hanging in
say.
Every... It's not.
How long has this been there for, approximately?
I opened maybe a year and a half ago, and it's cool. The coffee is really good. I'm not a huge fan of Takashi Murakami, but he's earned his, you know, way into heaven for putting a good coffee shop in Nakano Broadway, because there weren't a lot of them until then. And the only problem with it is that all of the game, and they use the cocktail cabinet style cabinets, but they're all emulations, which is fine, but they charge 500 yen a game, which is not,
whoa.
It's like, what? Like, I can literally play this thing on my iPhone if I want. And it's mainly aimed at tourists. You don't have to play the games to sit there and enjoy it, but, it is, what is it called? It's called Bar Zingalo, I think, or something like that. It was, I don't know what it's called now, but it's right there in that second floor, Nakano Broadway. Tell them Matt sent you.
I'm a little surprised that they're using emulation.
Will they knock the game prices down to 300 yen instead of 500 if I tell them you sent me?
Yeah, please. I would like them to knock it down to 100 yen. They'd still be making money off of this stuff. I don't know what the thinking is there, but the coffee is very good. It used to be run by a Scandinavian company called Fuglen. I don't know if it's still them, but the coffee is great. So, good place to rest after you have been stocking up on all of your otaku things from Nakano Broadway.
That's funny that they went with emulation. I feel like, you know, for a game that had a production run in the, you know, 200 to 300,000 units, probably could have sourced original boards that worked,
but
not too expensively here.
I don't think many of those old machines still exist. Like, either they got gutted and new things got put in, but Japan is very much like, you know, especially in the big cities, there's not a lot of space. And so big things like that get just junked. They get thrown away. And,
you could still find Invader boards on, like, Yahoo auctions pretty cheap, though. I've looked it up because I've thought about getting one here and
there. The hero move would have been filling this place with all, like, every kind of clone of Space Invaders.
Oh, man. That's true. That would probably be a little more difficult, yeah, but it would be pretty badass.
He has the money. He can do it. That would actually be performance art I would appreciate.
There we go.
Do you remember if the cabinets that they had there, because to my recollection, the original Japanese cabinets used a joystick for movement, whereas, as we'll probably get into in a moment, the U.S. counterparts had buttons for movement. Do you recall if they...
These are joystick. These are all modern. These are modern. The cabinets are emulated, too.
I see. Okay. I didn't know how closely they tried to, like, reproduce. No. Like, okay, they just didn't care about that. All right.
It's very much like a standard definition version.
I
see. Not high definition, if you get my drift.
Okay. All right.
It's close enough. I'm just glad there's no smoking in there, because speaking as somebody who spent a lot of time in Japan, like, even the first time I came here was during the bubble era. It was a smoky, smoky country.
Yeah, we kind of haven't said that out loud, but up until this point, yeah. Imagine all these invader rooms packed with machines, and almost every person inside is having a cigarette. Almost.
Absolutely reeking.
Every photo you see has, like, an overflowing ashtray on it from that era. It's just, it's filthy. It's horrible.
We we alluded to the American release, and let's pop into that real quick. So, you know, Midway got the license to it because Taito had originally intended to bring this out themselves. They had a small American branch. Once this game exploded in Japan, they're like, okay, there's no way we're going to possibly be able to keep this up. We have this good relationship with Midway. They have the production capacity to manage this. Let's let them handle it. Midway first showed it off in November at the industry trade show, the AMOA. There was a lot of interest, but not a lot of orders. But by February in 79, the game had blown up. Did not blow up to the same extent as Japan, but they still ended up selling somewhere around 65,000 units.
Which, again, that's
which,
like,
is a lot.
Those are, like,
for the U.S.
Those are Street Fighter II numbers. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we're talking about. Like,
yeah, their failure is like a huge success.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, Midway was not unhappy about this.
Yes.
But what I find really fascinating about the Western, like, release of this is Hawaii, you know, that was sort of located off the mainland, you know, partway towards Japan. They kind of got Space Invaders hooks in them before the mainland did. And they would be importing machines from Japan and bringing in the domestic ones from the U.S. as well. So it's sort of a real mix and match. Like, all right, is this machine one that has a joystick or one with buttons?
Right.
Take your pick.
I always get shocked when I see the old American machines with the buttons on them. Because I, like, somehow, even though that's how I played it as a kid, I remember it as a joystick.
Yeah.
I mean, I prefer the
joystick.
Yeah.
I would probably blame the Atari version, because obviously when I played it at home with the Atari, I had a joystick.
Right.
But yeah, it makes sense because I definitely played the arcade version, and I just, you know, I completely, you know, like, Mandela effect. Like, what do you mean buttons? It's joystick.
Yeah.
So here's a question, and this might be a little bit too philosophical for this group. I don't mean that as a slam or anything like that. This is just the kind of thing I think about way too much. Whenever I encountered Space Invaders or Pac-Man or whatever, they always had the Midway logo on them. And I never linked these things to Japan. It was much, much, much later that I ever made that connection. And I wonder if that was deliberate. You know, this was an era when Japan bashing was in full force, and a lot of companies went out of their way to hide the Japanese origins of the products they were selling. Like, Hasbro is another one. Like, you could be forgiven for, like, having grown up in the 80s and not realizing the Transformers were a Japanese toy line, you know, because there's a Marvel comic. They're all, like, they have, like, Western names, you know, they have Western voice actors and stuff. Nintendo is actually kind of a real trailblazer, because they're, like, coming in with, like, middle fingers extended. We're Japanese, you know, they were owning it. Like, they never made any, they never hid the fact they were Japanese at all. And actually, I remember talking to one of the people who was involved in marketing the NES back in 85. And he's like, oh yeah, no, We didn't bother hiding it was Japanese. In fact, we said these are the cutting edge games from Japan or something like that. But Space Invaders, Pac-Man, you know, like I didn't realize they were Japanese until much later.
Mm-hmm. I always assumed it was deliberate.
Right.
Yeah, I would figure as much.
Yeah, I mean, there's like still like a lot of like, remember Pearl Harbor, like people back around then, you know, mm-hmm. Our kids play Japanese games.
I say it was only a few decades since the war ended at that point. Lots of people were still alive from the war.
Oh, people were smashing Japanese cars with sledgehammers. They were, they were like smashing Japanese radios with sledgehammers. Like people, like ostensible adults were doing this while I was a kid, like playing with my Transformers and Shogun Warriors and, you know, reading manga and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, when you came up around Detroit, like you didn't drive around in a Japanese car unless you wanted someone smash it or key it.
There was a while there where that was 100% true. And like, even from a business perspective too, like I assume even if it wasn't, you know, necessarily like anti-Japan sentiment, it would have been, well, we're Midway, we're publishing this. We want people to think of Midway when they think of Space Invaders. Right. Why do we want them to think of Taito? Who cares about Taito? You know, we paid them their licensing fee already.
Which is extra funny to me because Midway, which was owned by Bally, and they had a home system, the Bally Professional Arcade, and they had a Space Invaders home version in like late 79, December 79, I think it was when it came out. And then the next month, Atari announced that they had made a deal with Taito directly to have a console exclusive for Space Invaders. So Midway or Bally had to just rapidly change the name of the game on all the labels.
Right.
From Space Invaders.
But, you know, Atari's was a licensed, like, portrayal. Is that what a port?
Yes, was it a licensed port? It was the first outside licensed video game that any company had done that I'm aware of. They'd done like a licensed Superman game, but that was super easy because Warner owned DC and Atari, so that's really in-house.
But Space Invaders moved a lot of 2600s is my impression. Yes. I mean, that's one of the most common cartridges. I remember that was the big thing. My dad, I remember my parents were like, wow, Space Invaders at home.
Yeah, so this home version, like, this was the game that set off the American video game boom. Like, I'd argue it's just as important as the arcade game, at least in the U.S.
Bigger than E.T.? Really?
This game sold... I'll put this into perspective. The 2600 version... So 2600 between 77 and 79, they sold about 1 million consoles, right? Space Invaders comes out in, I believe it was March 1980... And then, all of a sudden, they sold 1,000,000 2600s in that year alone, and even more in the subsequent years, until it ends its run at, what, like 20 or 30 million units? And Space Invaders sold, I think we know, somewhere around 6.5 million, or 6.2 million units.
Was it a pack-in?
No.
I don't remember that.
It was not a pack-in until 1982, when Sears made it a pack-in to replace Air Sea Battle. But for Atari-branded stuff, it was never a pack-in title. This was always its own thing.
It wasn't a particularly faithful rendition, but it was a satisfying one as compared to, say, 2600 Pac-Man, which I remember that was one of the first true disappointments in adult culture that I ever... Wow, grown-ups made this and it sucks this bad.
I think there's a key difference there because Pac-Man was made by someone who did not really like Pac-Man and as such didn't really know like what people liked about Pac-Man to try and pull in. Whereas Space Invaders, that was done by Rick Maurer, who was an Atari programmer who just come to the company from Fairchild, where he made games for the Channel F. He loved Space Invaders, and so even though they didn't have, like, the license to it or anything at that point, he's like, I'm going to make my own Space Invaders game based on, you know, what I can do with this system and what I've noticed just playing it at the arcade. So
smart thinking. You know, whenever I want a job done, I hire somebody who hates doing that
absolutely
job with all of their heart.
It's the way to do it.
You always get the best results that way.
Yes.
A feeling of power comes over your hand. Row by row, you're in command. There's one last devil moving real fast. One single shot, got him at last. Space Invaders.
Hey, wow, man.
Space Invaders.
So, like, he worked on this for, like, 4 or 5 months, and he was having a hard time making it run on the 2600 because the machine is not built to play Space Invaders. So he put it down and like started working on another game, Maze Craze. And then he picked it back up a few months later because Warner's CEO, Manny Girard, was like leaning on Atari to get the Space Invaders license because he had noticed just how many like people in general and Atari employees in particular were suddenly really into Space Invaders. And like separately, Epic, who had been distributing the 2600 in Japan, I don't remember their name for it. I'm sure if Jeremy were here, he'd know it off the top of his head. But they were having trouble like moving units, and they're like, hey, can you get Space Invaders on this thing? Because people will buy Space Invaders. So,
well, they actually had like big Space Invaders competitions. I remember that, like championships, like around America.
Yeah, Becky Heidemann, the game developer, won one. That was her claim to fame originally.
Yes, yes. What was she? When I was speaking to her for Pure Invention, not to keep plugging this book, although I will. she was talking. I was talking to her about like Game Boy games and later kind of things like that. She was actually a big source of information about how Americans developers saw the Game Boy back then, but. What was she really known for in the 80s? What is her big titles?
Oh God,
Bard's Tale. I think she's involved in Bard's Tale.
I don't.
It was PC games, I think mainly.
I don't remember off the top of my head. I wasn't really playing too many computer games
then,
in the 80s.
No, I'm just kidding.
I know she had an interview with Retronaut, so maybe. Go check
that
out.
And watch that. I'm fired. I didn't watch that. Sorry.
All I can think about is your story about the trying to port Doom to the 3DO and how terrible.
I do remember that story where they just like gave her the PC going like, yeah, you just plug this into the 3DO and it'll work, right?
She's like, that's how porting works. Sure.
Yeah. So a couple of fun little anecdotes from its development. So it does not have the Nagoya shot strategy. UFOs are always 200 points. But to make up for it, he threw in 112 game variations. Because
those old game systems had that.
That was like the solution to every problem at that point was more variations.
His reasoning is like, well, okay, if one of these is bad, then there's a bunch of other ones that people can try out and they might like one of them. So like you've got invisible invaders, you've got the barriers moving around, you've got shots that like move erratically, you've got fast shots. It's like a bunch of different two-player variations.
I know one of the simpler switches, it might have just been difficulty switch, just made your turret like three times as wide.
Yeah, so that difficulty switches just make you huge.
Yeah, so that just made it more challenging because you're now a huge target, but you're still only firing the one shot, and the invaders are the same size, but they can hit you way more easily than they can hit you. And I remember playing with it as a kid, you know, after a couple hours, like, okay, let's try this version, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
He actually had to design the invaders themselves because he was trying to get like an artist, like an actual professional dot artist to do it. And no one was available, or at least no one told him that when anyone was available.
I believe they were called pixel mongers back then.
So he had to do that. You know, it's a good term. I'm going to start using that now.
Really, I like the Atari creatures. They're cute little creatures, you know?
They are very cute. Yeah, yeah. They're iconic in their own way.
Your base looks better. Your base actually looks like a kind of like space arc or something like that, as I recall.
See, I always thought it looked like a Christmas tree when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know. But when it gets big, when you turn to that difficulty on high and it gets wide, it definitely looks like half a UFO or something.
Yeah. So. And I appreciate this. He apparently spent several days trying to, like, tune the audio just right. Because he's like, okay, the biggest part of the arcade game is the soundscape. I can't emulate that on the 2600 because the sound chip is not great. But I can do my best. Spent several days just on the sound.
What you mean is he took a deep inhale. Yeah, let me think about it.
It just felt like several days.
You know, I don't honestly know if he was one of the stoners on the staff at that point. Because, you know, this was post-Warner, and they were sort of trying to get a handle on that.
He tried it, but he didn't inhale, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where Moore is now. No one has had any contact with him since, like, the late 2000s. But everyone was like, this guy is awesome. He was a great developer. Apparently, he was the reason why they started getting royalties at Atari, because he only got a $3,000 bonus for this game.
Oh, my God.
And because that, you know, pissed him off and pissed off a bunch of other people, eventually people started leaving to start their own companies, and Atari's like, okay, how about we give you real royalties for making these games instead? Which is why Todd Fry made millions off of Pac-Man, even though he hated the game.
God, we should all be so lucky.
Right? And, you know, I think it's also fascinating because according to Moorer and like these early interviews that he did before he disappeared, is that you know, there was a big debate within Atari at the time. It's like, oh, should we do original games on the console? Because like, we're a console, we can do like not arcade stuff. Or should we just port arcade games? And because Space Invaders exploded beyond, you know, any other game on the platform, I think it was like the second bestseller after Pac-Man.
Right.
That sort of answered the question for management. Like, no, start making more arcade ports. And that sort of just became their bread and butter eventually.
And I would say, you know, we brought up E.T. earlier and Pac-Man. I think the success of Space Invaders probably informed those debacles, because the executives looked at Space Invaders and like, oh, we sold this many units. Well, now we can have, you know, Pac-Man is a huge hit. We can sell this many more units. And, oh, E.T. is the biggest, you know, is the highest grossing movie of all time. I'm sure if we make that into a game, we can sell even more units. But listeners, I'm moving my hand up every time to give a visual key here. But like, all they did was see, you know, line, they moved line up, and eventually they're, you know, I think at the end they were planning to sell more units than they had consoles, because they literally couldn't stop visioning more lines. It's like, no, it doesn't work at all. It doesn't work at all.
It's really funny. Like, it's a slight tangent. So like, a lot of the crash is because Atari couldn't keep up with demand, especially after Space Invaders came out. You know, Atari dominated the console space. Sort of like, okay, as a modern example, take the Switch and the PS5, or maybe the Switch and the Xbox series, whatever. And they're like, okay, this is the big one. This is the one that sold, you know, millions and millions of units. Here's one that sold like maybe a million, maybe two, if you're lucky, in comparison. So that's sort of the situation you were looking at. And Atari could not keep up with demand. They had to scale up their company so fast after Space Invaders exploded. Like, they did not expect this to be as big a hit it was. So,
And it went so well for them over the long run.
Oh yeah, it went great. They couldn't supply enough games and consoles to distributors and stores in 1980 and 81. So they started ordering more than they wanted, because they knew, like, okay, well, if we order double what we want, we'll get like the exact amount we want.
Yeah,
that'll not bite us in the butt or anything. And then 82, Atari finally caught up to orders. And suddenly, everyone had more stuff than they wanted, and that just brought the whole system down. So, Space Invaders gave us the video game boom, and it gave us the video game crash indirectly.
it giveth and it taketh away.
It is the destroyer of worlds in the U.S.
Yeah. It's the video game equivalent.
The original land of contrasts.
Man who walks in a humble way.
So going over some of the like little Space Invaders clones, we have Space Invaders Part 2, released in the U.S. as Deluxe Space Invaders. This was
I hate that they changed the naming like this. Like,
it's really stupid.
Yeah. It makes you, someone could be forgiven for thinking that this is just a slightly enhanced version of the original Space Invaders. And I guess maybe you can argue that it is, but like, it turns the scoring strategies on their heads, kind of, because they have just enough differences to kind of muck up your shot counting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this game didn't take off quite to the same extent, probably because of the, you know, crushing of the invader boom in Japan. But like, it does some interesting things. Like, it has like cute little cutscenes. which I don't think, I can't think of too many examples before that point.
Oh, the first, I mean, I don't think so, because, I mean, Pac-Man is, what, 80, so this mm-hmm. is definitely first, so,
yeah.
before Pac-Man anyway.
And they're cute, and, like, they're calling for backup. And they do some, like, other interesting twists on the formula that make it less fun to try and get a high score in. But
I wish they wouldn't call for backup, like, spawn invaders into other invaders, which is really what screws up your shot count. And, like, depending on when they do it, if it's too close to the end of the line, like, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
There might be ways around that. I haven't really delved in deep to try to figure out, like, how you can modify the strategy for Space Invaders Part 2. But, like, also less people seem to care about that in general. Like, I think yeah. people would rather just play the first Space Invaders versus Part 2 / Deluxe.
Yeah, this one you really have to play it more straight, I feel yeah. like. So, like, yeah, you have the invaders that can, like, split apart when you shoot them. They're the ones that, like, expand in really weird ways when they're, like, stomping around. The mystery ship can drop off extra yeah. UFOs. And also sometimes you get a different mystery ship that just sort of blinks and is really, really annoying to try and hit.
Yeah, extremely. And like if you're going, like you can still use, you know, the shot counting stuff all still works. You just have to be really prepared to for the game to cause you to miss your count. And like you can't find yourself in a position where it's like, okay, I missed it. Now I lost my count. Now I'm all screwed up. Like this game will help you like recover from failure, basically.
Yeah, but I will give it this much. So there was a rumor going around when Space Invaders came out. So there's a bug in the game where the last invaders on the screen is one of the little bottom ones, like I don't know, what are they supposed to be, octopus or something?
I think so.
If you shoot that one last, or if you leave one of those last, it'll leave like a little trail on the screen yeah. as it goes back and forth. And there was a rumor that if you did that for like a whole row of them, something would happen. And in this game, they made that into something real. Nishikado did. If you destroy one of those invaders last, you get a little graphical rainbow and it gives you a bunch of bonus points, which is cute. I've done that a few times. It's not as much fun as, you know, Nagoya attacking them, but
but what is really
there. But I think is fascinating is that this game came out in September in Japan, the same time that Galaxian came out in Japan. And guess which one did a lot better?
Yeah, I can kind of understand why, too.
Yeah. But, and you know, we've been talking about Taito's arcades, and I think this might have been one of their first ones, or at least it was a big one. They opened an arcade in Kabukicho in August 79. And that included Space Invaders Part 2, like, a month early. But it was a special one. It was Space Invaders Jumbo, which I've really only seen references to a few times. These were just, like, cabinets with massive screens running Space Invaders Part 2.
Huh.
But they were, like, 200 yen a pop, which that's double the price of a normal machine. And the boom had already ended, so, like, they didn't really make very many. It's a game. It's worth checking out, but you're not going to get super stoked about it, I feel like.
Be warned, when you see that deluxe label, some of your stuff might not work if you're playing for score.
The big screen version reminds me of a version I've seen, like, recently, where it's like...
Gigamax?
Yeah, like, they've repurposed the Space Invaders icon to sort of, like, be a... almost like a sit-down shooter with big-ass guns, and the invaders come down, but, like, the screen is huge. I played that with my son a couple years ago, like, in Florida, and, like, we just, you know, it's obviously a very different game because it plays differently, but the iconography and all the characters are still there, but the size of it, it reminds me of this concept, like, hey, if you like Space Invaders, look at this giant Space Invaders machine. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, do it.
In the U.S., you can find it in pretty much any Dave & Buster's or similarly, like, family-friendly kind of place that, you know, still may have some... redemption style, like arcade games or whatever, for like kids to win tickets for prizes or whatever.
Yeah, we were in a mall.
But it is cool.
We were in a mall shopping, mall arcades. So yeah,
that would make sense.
That would be where they'd keep it, yeah. for sure.
But it is cool that they like reused Space Invaders for that and kind of like reinvented it a little bit for, you know, ostensibly a new generation. But yes, I can tell you that the Nagoyuchi does not work in that version of the game. I tried.
As much as we wish it would.
Yeah.
Think of all the tickets you'd get with that. You could get anything you want out of the counter.
What would Michael Kogan think? An actual gun!
Brian, do you just try the Nagoya strategy on every game you play? Like, when you play Final Fight, do you try Nagoya strategy?
No!
Maybe. I mean, what if it worked in Final Fight 3? We wouldn't know unless you tried.
You don't know until you try, do you?
Here's a game I've never really tried it for. So, you know how Midway made a bunch of, like, Pac-Man sequels and whatnot? Well, they did kind of the same thing with Space Invaders. They made Gorf by Jamie Fenton. She developed it at Dave Nutting Associates. So this is like a five-stage shooting game. And the first stage is Space Invaders. And the third stage is Galaxian, because they had the rights to that as well. There's a few differences. Like, there's different types of UFOs. You can move up and down. Your shots can be canceled and refired. It's weird. It's a weird take on Space Invaders. It's supposed to be very, like, slight, so I've never bothered trying to play it in the traditional scoring sense, but, like, it's there. It's cool. If you see Gorf, you can have some fun with the booming audio. It's a different sound chip than Space Invaders, but it's very loud.
Thank you, Kevin, for putting this in the notes, because honestly, that was probably, this, like, unlocked a 40-year-old memory in my brain, because I had Gorf for the Commodore 64. And I absolutely played it a lot because it was one of the, you know, one of the early Commodore 64 games that we had. And it made sense to me because I had played a lot of Space Invaders. And I don't know if I actually thought hard about the name, because looking at it now, I wonder if it's just, is it just Frog Backwards? It could be Frog Backwards.
It is just Frog Backwards.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, Bally also released a Space Invaders pinball machine, which has absolutely nothing to do with Space Invaders other than using the sound effects. But that was enough to make, like, 11,000 of these things, which is a pretty good production number for pinball. They had to stop production early because their back glass art looked too close to unused art for Alien, done by H.R. Giger. So, I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with that one, but Godspeed. God bless them.
I'm staring directly at Brian. Brian, does the Nagoya strategy work in the pinball game?
I've not actually played the pinball game, believe it or not. I admit I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around how you would even try it in pinball.
You know, I was at an arcade over the weekend that had the pinball machine, and I did not have any coinage for it, so I got screwed out of playing it.
You may have to confirm that for us, probably the closest person to one. I don't visit Galloping Ghost pinball building too much. I mostly stick to the video games, but there's also a chance that they may have it too.
Maybe. I mean, 11,000 units, that's quite a few for pinballs. I'm sure there's quite a few floating around still. And then the last one I wanted to bring up, this is Invader's Revenge, and I'm bringing it up because it is so beyond, like, what you'd expect out of a Space Invaders clone. So this was developed by a British company called Zenitone and released January 81. I saw it described once as, it is to Space Invaders what Doki Doki Panic is to Super Mario Brothers. Basically, it runs on Space Invaders hardware with an extra soundboard with, like, AY8910 chips to produce, like, sound and music. Like, it has actual music in it. And it's sort of like a weird mashup of Space Invaders, Galaxian, Donkey Kong 3, and Sega's Astro Blaster. So, like, these invaders are coming out in different formations and patterns. They're floating around. They're going to try and steal, like, blocks of fuel from the bottom of the screen and carry them back up to the UFO at the top. If you destroy all the invaders in a wave, you'll go to a screen where you have to dock with your mothership to get more fuel. Like, you should look up YouTube videos of this, because it is honestly wild that it's running on the same hardware as the original game.
Can we please briefly mention Pepsi Invaders?
I think it's worth mentioning Pepsi Invaders. This is a rendition of the 2600 Space Invaders game that was developed as a promotional item for a Coca-Cola sales convention in 1983.
That's the twist. You hear the words Pepsi Invaders, like, oh, it's like a Pepsi branded Space Invaders to sell more Pepsi. No.
Yeah.
No, it was made by Coke because they hate Pepsi.
They only made 125 of these, and they, you know, gave them out to company executives. The ROM's been dumped since the 90s, so by all means, take a look at it. It's really funny. Like, you cannot lose, because Coke cannot lose against Pepsi.
It says Coke wins at the end of every single level every time, which for the longest time, I thought the game was called Coke Wins. But you can be forgiven for making that mistake because Coke always wins.
It's true.
It's the video game equivalent of putting your rival's face on a dartboard. It's so funny. It is. It's so funny.
Oh, see, how come Capcom and SNK never quite did that? Right. Like, you have Dan Hibiki, but he's not just straight up Robert Garcia.
Right.
I think that's Space Invaders. Does anyone else have anything they want to talk about? Any final thoughts on how this game sort of impacted everything?
Yeah, I mean, stating the obvious, there's a strong argument for it to be made of, like, giving birth to the shmup genre. I mean, it's a pretty far cry from what those games would turn into, like, even a small handful of years later. But, like, I don't know that we would have had even like a Gradius or anything without Space Invaders existing. Like, you put them next to each other and it may be hard to recognize the similarities if you don't know what you're looking for. But I'm pretty sure none of that would have happened if Space Invaders hadn't brought them to life.
I would argue it is probably one of the most important video games ever made, if not the most important from Japan's perspective. And then below that large claim is like, yeah, I think it absolutely invented the shooter genre as we know it. And I think it's the main reason that shooter games continue to succeed, at least in Japan to this day. I think now with the internet being the way it is, I think you're getting more shooter fans overseas. And thanks to Steam, the fact that you can make, you know, a hobbyist or whatever can make, like a doujin shooter that has lots of weird characters in it, but it's still scrolling up and you're shooting lots of enemies, which makes it like the grandchild of Space Invaders. And you can put that on Steam. And if you work on it yourself, maybe you sell 1,000 copies and that you break even, you know, like there's a whole world out there of people who maybe if they never played Space Invaders are making and loving games that are directly descended from Space Invaders. So I really don't think you can undersell the impact. Again, I made a joke at the start of this podcast. I really don't think I was joking. I really feel like without Space Invaders, Japan as a nation, as a society, does not exist in the same way that it exists today. Really doesn't. The economy? Yeah. I mean, the fact that it literally impacted the economy, like the number of coins that were circulation, like that's not a small feat, you know? Street Fighter II never did that.
That's true. And, you know, you think about it, games like Donkey Kong exists because Nintendo had a bunch of Radarscope machines that they needed to sell. Yeah. Radarscope was a offshoot of Space Invaders game design. Same with Galaxian, which was Namco's big breakout hit.
Kevin, I just wrote about this in my weekly column, which is available to all Patreon backers at $5 or more. I just wrote about this weekly column when I talked about Twinbee. Twinbee turned 40.
Mm-hmm.
And Twinbee is absolutely Twinbee is more of a Zevius, but still. That is the cute-em-up, and the cute-em-up derives from the shoot-em-up, and we still have cute-em-ups today because we have shoot-em-ups in the first place. It's all connected. And I talked about the fact that, yes, Space Invaders was so popular, even a failed Space Invaders clone gave us Donkey Kong, which basically invented Nintendo as we know it. Like, it's all connected. Just picture me on that board like Charlie Day in It's Always Sunny. Like, it's all connected.
I find it really funny to think that, okay, if you trace it back, the entire, like, shooter genre goes back to Pong to break out to Space Invaders, and not to Space War, which you would think it would
be
true. Space War.
No, not Computer Space.
It's a shooting
not
game.
Not Computer Space, sorry.
No, Computer Space, no, it's Pong. Cracks me up. And now that's probably going to sit with everyone who's listening to this in horrifying ways. Yeah, anything else? I think we're good. Yeah, this has been Retronauts. This is a Patreon-supported show. If you are a Patreon, or if you are a patron already, that's fantastic. If you're not, what are you doing with your life? You could be supporting us at patreon.com/retronauts, $3 level. You get each episode 1 week early and at a higher bitrate. $5 level, you get the aforementioned weekly columns by Diamond and Friday bonus episodes. So you should check it out. You should subscribe if you're not. And where can we find you, Diamond?
Well, beyond my Retronauts work, which I should also mention includes a monthly community podcast, which I usually host, and our Discord access, which we're doing a lot of stuff in there all the time. That's all at $5 level. But beyond my Retronauts work, you can find me around the internet by looking for Fight Club. F-E-I-T is my last name. C-L-U-B. That is a business that might contain Invader games. We don't know what's going on inside those closed doors. It's a private club. I also have a website, which is fightclub.me. I made it myself. It looks very old because I don't really know a lot about HTML because I learned it like 30 years ago. But, you know, it works enough for me.
Yeah. Matt, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me all over the internet. I'm on Instagram at altmattalt. I have a newsletter, the Pure Invention newsletter, blog.pureinventionbook.com. And I'm on YouTube. There's a channel. Look up Matt Alt Japan. But it's always great being on here. I like talking about things other than Space Invaders too. There's another game, I think, or maybe even a couple more games out there besides that one. So let's do this again sometime soon.
Yeah. Well, we're ready for Custer's Revenge. I know you've been gunning for that one.
Oh yeah. Or Gigolo. What was it called? Like, isn't that the other one in that? 2600 Gigolo? I should.
That is a game on there. And I'll probably have to cover it someday.
It's your fate.
It is my fate. And Brian, where can we find you?
Sure. I'm on Blue Sky as BClarkOMP, and I run 1millionpower.com, where you can find translations on a lot of Japanese game and music-related articles on stuff that tends to be a little bit less mainstream. YouTube.com/BClarkOMP, where I do videos on a lot of things, but most featured, I guess, is Scrolling Down the Belt, a series that goes through games in the beat-em-up genre in mostly chronological order. And relevant to this episode, I did a video on how you can learn how to get a high score in Space Invaders. So check that out if you're interested in learning some of the stuff that I alluded to. There's a Patreon for all of that if you like what you see at patreon.com/1millionpower. And finally, I have a book that's been out for a little while, Gameplay Harmonies, Japanese Recording Artists and the Video Games About Them, which you can buy at limitedrungames.com or also Amazon.
And as for myself, that was good to do in a couple of breaths. You can find me on Blue Sky at atariarchive.org, which is my website, and I have a book available through Limited Run and on Amazon, also Atari Archive, Volume 1. It covers 1977 and 1978 of the Atari 2600's life. It's a spinoff, an offshoot, if you will, of the video series I've been doing on YouTube since 2017. Jeez.
Oh my God, it's been that long.
It has been that long. Wow. And I did cover Space Invaders for the 2600 there. If you have not heard me talk about it enough, you can do that there. And you can support me as well through Patreon at Atari Archive. And with that, I bid you adieu and keep watching the skies. I mean, skies.
Today's Tom Sawyer, he gets high on you. When the space he invades, he gets by on you.
Good night. Good night. Good night. Good night. I'm not going to stop. You have to stop me.
There, you are stopped.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.